The Guardian.
Rebel Tories finally get some say in COVID restrictions as the Speaker of the House scolds the government's, quote, contempt for Parliament. I'm Jessica Elgott, Deputy Political Editor of The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
Today I can confirm to the House that for significant national measures with effect in the whole of England or UK-wide, we will consult Parliament. Wherever possible, we will hold votes before such regulations come into force.
Yesterday, Rebel Conservative MPs secured a deal to give the House of Commons more power over sweeping coronavirus restrictions. The government finally caved in and gave MPs a vote in Parliament on any new UK or England-wide coronavirus restrictions, after up to 100 Conservatives threatened a rebellion. So will this go far enough to appease those rumbling Tory backbenchers? And will added scrutiny convince ministers, including Boris Johnson, to get to know their own lockdown restrictions? As we saw this week, it's much easier to get them muddled than the Prime Minister would have liked.
On the rule of six, outside the areas where, such as the North East, where extra measures have been brought in, it's six inside, six outside, and in the North East.
If they can't handle simple questions from the press, how will they fare against worried MPs? With all of that going on, you'd be forgiven for forgetting, or not realising at all, that the Lib Dem conference was on last weekend. Later on, I'll speak to two former members of the party to discuss the path ahead for the UK's third party. Plus, Fiona Harvey reports on the latest news around the COP26 UN climate change summit. That's all on this week's Politics Weekly. But first, as we recorded, we found out the EU has launched legal action against the UK for breaching the Brexit withdrawal agreement. And you can read our reporting on the fallout of this from the Guardian website. And if all of that wasn't enough, we reported yesterday that Number 10 is looking at sending asylum seekers to places like Morocco, Moldova, and even Papua New Guinea. To talk about this and everything else, I'm joined by Sonia Soda, the chief leader writer for The Observer. So let's start with this news from the Guardian exclusive on Wednesday evening that, according to some leaked documents, the government is taking a serious look at detaining asylum seekers in offshore detention centres. And it looks like the Foreign Office is pushing back against the plans, but our story reveals that it's, you know, not just some blue sky thinking, it's coming directly from Number 10. Obviously, in the reporting, it just sort of sounds balmy, but it is actually more serious than that, isn't it?
It is more serious than that, I think, but it is a totally bonkers idea, and it would be very, very difficult to do without massively breaking international law. And obviously, we know the government have got a bit of a track record on that. But I think the way to look at this is really, I think it's kind of forces within Downing Street trying to position themselves in relation to a culture war, associating themselves with ideas, trying to show the public that they're kind of on the right side of this sort of culture war question, while knowing that it's going to get kicked back by sort of reasonable forces within the civil service. And if you think about it, it suits somebody like Dominic Cummings on two counts, because first of all, you're continuing to pick this sort of culture wars fight and show that you're a really kind of anti-immigration government, even though we're talking here about asylum seekers rather than immigrants, economic immigrants. And then secondly, it enables you to make this argument about, you know, the civil service sort of getting in the way of a democratically elected government doing what they want to do. So I think you're right that it's not kind of completely blue skies. It's clearly come from somebody, come from kind of senior sources within government, but it is also completely bonkers and just won't fly.
I mean, you mentioned the this idea of it being a bit like kind of a bit of red meat to the Tory right when there is this plan to exploit the culture wars, and probably there's an expectation it can't be done. But what do you make of the sources in our story saying there's an explicit desire to return to this hostile environment for asylum seekers? And that was something that, you know, people within the government, although that was Sajid Javid before he was ousted, have said they didn't like that language anymore, but now there seems to be a desire to go back to it.
Well, if we go back to kind of vote leave, we know that, you know, it was a very, very, and that was a campaign that was spearheaded by Dominic Cummings, the Prime Minister's most senior advisor. Boris Johnson was kind of one of the chairs of that campaign. And that campaign, basically, you know, it was successful in part because it was a really fear-mongering campaign and kind of basically misled the public about the dangers of immigration, for example. So in some ways, it's not a surprise that they're willing to go back to this, particularly when they're under so much kind of political scrutiny at the moment. I sort of feel like they think this is their comfort zone. However, I think it's actually a massive political mistake for them. I think it really underestimates the British public. There was no demand from the British public for the hostile environment. And I think the stuff that kind of relies on quite kind of nasty sort of dog whistles is not actually necessarily that effective in winning support from a broad base of people. But I do think, as you say, sort of as you hinted there, it is kind of red meat to a small section of the electorate. So I think it's not a surprise that they're doubling down on this stuff, but I'm not sure that it's actually going to be that effective.
Well, moving on, that news came after quite a busy day in Parliament where there was quite an interesting back and forth with a number of backbench MPs who had backed this amendment to give them more say over these COVID restrictions for various procedural reasons that the Speaker wasn't able to select the amendment. But there was a pretty public dressing down of the Prime Minister for his contempt, in Lindsay Hoyle's words, for Parliament. And there was a deal eventually brokered by Matt Hancock to give MPs a vote ahead of UK-wide restrictions, not local lockdowns. Do you think the government needed to give this concession, given the weight behind this amendment, even though it didn't get picked? And also, I'm sort of interested in your thoughts about whether it's really much of a concession at all.
I think they did need to make a concession. I think the government recognised that. I think there's been quite a lot of dissent on the Conservative backbenches in recent weeks with the government's kind of handling of the pandemic. So obviously there's a massive advantage in having a majority of 80, but another sort of aspect of having such a big majority is that troublemakers can kind of feel like it's sort of a bit low stakes to create trouble because not everything comes to a knife edge vote. So I think the government recognised that in order to ward off sort of future trouble, it needed to give some sort of concession. I think whether this goes far enough still very much remains to be seen, because at the moment, the kind of key approach really seems to be local restrictions, which actually it sort of leaves space for a whole new sort of political argument. There's also kind of distance between what the government's doing and local leaders who say that they're just not getting enough advance notice of it. And again, the government's just steaming ahead. But the government will care a lot less about that because a lot of the leaders of these regions are Labour mayors.
Do you foresee any problems with votes on something as strict as that getting through? There are a lot of Conservative MPs who are pretty angry generally with the curbs on people's freedoms and think it's not realistic to wait for a vaccine in order for those curbs to end. So could they be in trouble with these votes?
I don't foresee trouble with the votes because I think actually you would probably get enough support from opposition MPs, and in particular it'll be interesting to see what the Labour Party does. But if the Labour Party feel that there is a need for these restrictions and they're justified, I think you would get the Labour Party supporting them. So you might be in the sort of interesting position whereby you have a conservative rebellion, whether that means the government would have to rely on Labour votes or Lib Dem votes to get restrictions through, I think remains to be seen. But you might get more of a...
That would be embarrassing, wouldn't it?
It would be really, really embarrassing. But I think... I don't really foresee problems with these restrictions going through. I think the big difference will come if you have more parliamentary scrutiny, that the government will have to account for these measures much more precisely, and they'll have to be much more exacting about the scientific evidence behind them. So, for example, I think the rule of six would have got through, but the 10 p.m. curfew, I'm not so sure about. By all accounts, that 10 p.m. curfew, it wasn't particularly well thought through. It came about as a result of, you know, Number 10 sort of wanting a two-week so-called circuit breaker, so a national kind of strict lockdown in order to try and bring infection rates down. And apparently the Treasury were not into that. Rishi Sunak was not into that. So there was a bit of scrabbling around. And then the 10 p.m. curfew was arrived at as a bit of a sort of face saver. The main difference difference it would make if government had to bring measures before Parliament is that it would have to give more thought to this, and it would have to, it would be called to account for the scientific evidence. So I think you'd see them putting forward measures that were more thought through rather than them putting forward a whole host of measures that sort of get rejected by MPs.
What do you make of this idea? You sort of touched on it, that the Prime Minister and the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, aren't quite on the same page when it comes to the restrictions. Sunak, I thought, was quite striking last week when he said we need to learn to live without fear. And that wasn't really borne out in the press conference that Boris Johnson gave yesterday, where he said that things were really serious, and even though there were no specific new announcements, it was just a sort of underlining that the public needs to follow the rules and that more restrictions are possible.
I think there's definitely a gap between Rishi Sunak and Number 10 and Boris Johnson on this. And I think you're starting to see quite a lot of annoyance develop within Number 10 with the Treasury and with Rishi Sunak. And I think he's seen as a bit of a threat to Boris Johnson, a kind of early threat to Boris Johnson. And he's sort of seen as kind of trying to cultivate his own supporter base. He's sort of one of the only members of the cabinet who has like kind of really positive approval ratings and who is recognised kind of independently by members of the public. But I do think what's interesting about this is, you know, Boris Johnson has literally just won a majority of 80. Normally, no one would even be sort of considering who's coming up next, who's a threat to him. The reason that we are all talking about that now is because he is seen to be doing really pretty badly. His poll ratings aren't great. You know, the government's handling of the COVID crisis is thought to have been pretty bad. And, you know, there are sort of noises on his backbenches, which is, I think, why we're talking about this when we wouldn't normally be, when a prime minister had won a majority of 80 less than a year ago.
Good afternoon. When I spoke to you all last week, I explained that the number of COVID patients going into hospital had doubled in a fortnight.
And this press conference was his 100th press conference on coronavirus, and it kind of was a bit of a throwback to the spring when we saw him flanked always by the chief medical officer for England, Chris Whitty, and the chief scientific advisor, Patrick Vallance. But there wasn't actually any sort of new announcements, really. And do you think it was just a warning to his backbenchers to keep taking things seriously, that there was really is no other way to beat the virus other than these restrictions on socialising and on normal life? Was there anything else behind it, do you think?
I think it was partly that. And it was also sort of, you know, trying to set the tone with the nation. It's a difficult time. Lots of, you know, people are living in areas where there are more restrictions kind of coming in. And so I think probably Number 10 felt that they had to sort of send a message and to speak directly to the public again. And I think they probably also wanted to counteract this sort of sense from Rishi Sunak that, you know, this is just something that we're going to have to learn to live with. I mean, it is something we're going to have to learn to live with, but we're also going to have to put up with some, you know, pretty restrictive kind of measures over the next few months. So I think it was very much a laying the ground press conference for what's to come in the next sort of 2 or 3 weeks.
And of course, obviously, possibly he wanted to show that he was in control of the rules after that,
yes,
that mess up earlier in the week where he got the rules in the northeast wrong. But then we've also had this week his father, Stanley Johnson, is out not wearing a mask in a shop. And we've got Jeremy Corbyn pictured at a dinner party, which has 9 people at it. I mean, can we really totally blame Boris Johnson for sowing all this confusion and the government for not getting it right? Or is there, you know, is there more to it than that?
Yes, we can blame our Prime Minister for not being clear on what local restrictions apply in which part of the country. I mean, it was just a flabbergasting moment, really. And it really does sort of raise the question, if you can't get it right as Prime Minister, how are you expecting all of your citizens to sort of know the restrictions? And I think people really do want to do the right thing. The government haven't made it easy. For example, there's no way on the app, for example, to figure out exactly what restrictions are in place in which local area. You've got to sort of work that out yourself through Googling. And it does get quite complicated because there are different rules. It shows that one of his weaknesses is just system, a sort of really flawed attention to detail. But I do think, you know, the fact that his dad was, you know, fine, his dad doesn't hold public office himself, but he is a prime minister's dad, you know, caught in a shop without a mask, Jeremy Corbyn at a dinner party with nine people. These are people in the public eye who should really be setting an example. And I don't think Stanley Johnson or Jeremy Corbyn have that much in common. But perhaps one thing they both do have in common is a belief that they're somehow above the rules that apply to everyone else.
Thanks ever so much, Sonia.
Take care, Jess.
After the break, we look at the latest news from the COP26 summit and what are the main takeaways from this week's Liberal Democrat conference. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Jessica Elgott. Now, the UK was due to host the COP26 UN Climate Change Conference in November, but as the pandemic spread around the world, the decision was made to postpone the summit for a year. But things are still happening behind the scenes as the government prepares to welcome global leaders in 13 months' time. But who will be welcoming them? As we reported last week, activists voiced their anger when they realised the UK is fielding an all-male team to host COP26. Despite the blatant lack of diversity in the UK's team, commentators also pointed out that women in developing countries are among those worst and most immediately hit by climate breakdown. So what else is happening with summit preparations? The Guardian's environment correspondent Fiona Harvey has this report.
Making history at the UN in New York. As Earth Day was being observed around the planet, a record number of countries signed the historic Paris Accord to slow global warming.
The COP26 summit is the next round of United Nations talks on the climate crisis. It's seen as one of the last chances to put the world on track to meet the goals of the Paris Agreement of 2015. All of the world's governments agreed in Paris to hold global temperature rises to well below 2 degrees Celsius. Within the Paris Agreement, there is a mechanism for strengthening those commitments every 5 years. So that means that by the end of 2020, countries are supposed to come up with new national plans for strengthening their commitments to cut greenhouse gas emissions. So that's what COP26 is all about. World leaders meeting to agree publicly to increase their country's actions on the climate in line with scientific advice.
We have to deal with our CO2 emissions, and that is why the UK is calling for us to get to net zero as soon as possible, for every country to announce credible targets to get there. That's what we want from Glasgow.
Before the COVID-19 pandemic hit is when the UK launched its presidency of COP26. The launch in February was overshadowed by the rather botched sacking of the chief UK official.
Claire O'Neill was until Friday in charge of the climate change summit. Suddenly sacked by Boris Johnson, she hasn't gone quietly.
And then the expected timetable and the launch of this big diplomatic push didn't really get off the ground before coronavirus hit. And of course, then everyone was thrown into turmoil. Some experienced observers were urging the government and the UN to stick to the original timetable, which was to have COP26 in Glasgow this November. But as the early weeks of lockdown passed, the scale of the pandemic and the response to it became increasingly clear, and it was impossible to keep going. In April, the UN and the UK and various other countries involved all agreed that it should be postponed for a whole year to next November 2021.
We were the first, after all, to industrialise. Look at the historic emissions of the UK. We have a responsibility to our planet to lead in this way.
One thing it's important to note is that the timetable for COP26 has not changed in one important respect, and that is countries still have until the end of this year to come up with their new national plans on emissions under the terms of the Paris Treaty. That's why Boris Johnson has called an extra interim summit ahead of COP26. He's just announced this. It will take place in December this year on the 5th anniversary of the Paris Agreement. And that is where world leaders and heads of state and government will be invited to come and make their pledges. So that should really set the scene for COP26 next year. It should get a lot of that initial work out of the way, if it goes according to plan.
We want to create green jobs. This is going to be a green recovery with concern for our environment at its heart.
One of the advantages of delaying COP26 is that governments can tie their response to the COVID-19 crisis to their response to the climate crisis. They can put those two things together and hopefully ensure that the recovery from coronavirus is both green and low carbon, so that when we rebuild the world after COVID, we don't stoke the climate crisis further by opting for high carbon economic growth. So what that means in practice is not handing billions in taxpayers' money over to stricken industries like airlines or oil companies. They've seen their prices go through the floor, but choosing carefully where to put the stimulus money. So ensuring that any money that does go to these fossil fuel or high carbon industries comes with green strings attached, meaning that they commit to reducing their emissions in return for any bailout. So the idea of a green recovery is actually very popular in the UK, but the response from the government has been rather less ambitious than many people had hoped. The Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, he set out for people to apply for grants to make their homes more energy efficient. But that's only started off this month, and we'll have to wait and see how effective it is. And that really is about it on the UK's green recovery. That's really the only green recovery measure that has been announced.
We've come a long way, not least in the past year. But over the next 14 months to COP26, I am calling on the world to up its ambition.
There's no doubt about it, COP26 is an absolutely vital summit. So the UK government is exposed in this in a way it never has been before. It will be scrutinised internationally in a way it never has been before. And now on targets, the UK is doing very well. It has one of the most ambitious long-term targets in the world. It's aiming to be net zero carbon emissions by 2050. But it's not just about having targets, it's about meeting targets. And so what the government needs to do now is come forward with actual policies to implement that long-term target. So we will need much more in terms of renewable energy. We need to see policies. And if we do, then that will give the government the credibility that it needs to lead COP26.
The Guardian's Fiona Harvey there. Now, last week we covered how Keir Starmer and the rest of the Shadow Cabinet did as they kicked off conference season. And this week it's the Liberal Democrats' turn. To discuss how it went, I spoke to two former Lib Dem members, Naomi Smith, the chief executive of the pro-EU group Best for Britain and the co-host of the Remainiacs podcast, and Polly McKenzie, the chief executive of Demos and a former advisor to Ed Davey and Nick Clegg. With conferences taking place online, I wanted to know if the pair had been following this weekend's events. I asked Polly first.
No, I haven't really paid attention to any of the conferences. You know, when Keir Starmer made his speech, my instant reaction was, oh, that's interesting. I wonder why he's decided to make a big landmark speech. And then I went, oh yeah, hang on, it's conference week. And so with the Lib Dems, I got an email saying conference starts in 1 hour. And it's really quite different if you're not already on a train to the conference. I spoke at a fringe event, which was very nice, about generous liberalism. And other than that, I have paid literally no attention.
And I'm no longer a Lib Dem member, so I wasn't eligible to attend the conference, as a delegate. And so the only bit I paid attention to was their debate on Europe, which was quite interesting.
Given the enormity of the threat to our country, it's with deep regret and sadness that I must say this government and this Prime Minister have just not risen to this challenge.
So Ed Davey was the one to give the leader's speech. He's not been party leader very long, only just been elected by the party members. So Polly, did you catch any of that, or at least any of the sort of core messages that he wanted to give out?
Yeah, I thought where he was most compelling was when he was talking about himself and his experiences, lifelong experiences as a carer.
You see, I've been a carer for much of my life. First, as a teenager, when I nursed my mum during her long battle against bone cancer.
First, as a kid, losing his parents, caring for his mum, caring for his gran, and then obviously as the father also of a profoundly disabled son who is a delight, as anyone who's met him knows, but nevertheless requires real effort. And I think Ed's ability to understand and empathise with, you know, the 9 million people who have caring responsibilities in our society is a compelling political story. I guess the challenge, though, is it's probably not enough in politics to be a nice guy. And I'm also not sure there's anyone in politics who's anti-carer. It's an interesting choice for him to focus on that. But given that nobody knows who he is yet, it was nice to see him be personal and reflective and empathetic.
I'd echo much of what Polly says. You know, this is an incredibly personable politician who is very good at connecting with people, particularly on a one-to-one level. I suppose where I'm slightly concerned is around the fact that he wants to spend a very long period of time on a listening tour.
But as I travel the country listening to people, as I hear what they are doing to beat the threat of coronavirus, to support their neighbours...
I think that has echoes of what Paddy Ashdown did in the early 90s, but he's doing it in a very, very different way. And the times are very, very different as well, because we now don't have the same levels of local media that Paddy was able to leverage then in order to really raise his own profile and that of the party and the policies it stood for. So I think I would probably have some concern over that as an approach, because I just don't think it can work quite as well in the modern day.
Polly, it sounds like maybe he is trying to draw some lessons from Lib Dem leaders of the past. What lessons do you think he'll have learned from Joe Swinson and the way that they ran the election last year?
There was a huge amount of false hope and optimism, because in the first half of last year, the Liberal Democrats were up at 20% in the polls. They did well in the European elections that we had to have. And so there was that sense that Brexit was stoppable and the Liberal Democrats were the force that was going to deliver it. And somehow all of that belief, not just in the Lib Dems, but also in the idea that Brexit was stoppable, just evaporated during that general election campaign. And the Liberal Democrats went to this election campaign with incredibly radical position to sort of just stop Brexit without a referendum, and missed the realization that the public had moved on. And I think what Ed has learnt from that is that he shouldn't be the one banging on about Brexit. It is, in fact, just at the wrong time when we are going to see the reality of how awful Brexit really is.
Naomi, do you agree with that? Do you think that it's wrong for the Lib Dems to accept, I assume you probably do, think it's wrong for the Lib Dems to accept that the UK is leaving the EU and then start to refocus on other national or local issues?
The problem that the Liberal Democrats have time and time again is that they fight yesterday's fight. And they're just not in the same place as they were in December 2019. They've fallen even further back since the general election. They got 11.5% of the national vote share then. And they lack that core vote that they previously had. You know, for much of the 20th century, the Liberal Democrats were propped up by the rural working class, areas that were anti-establishment, areas away from the centres of power and wealth that felt neglected by both Labour and the Conservatives. So had these long-standing ties with the Liberal Party. Then comes along Charles Kennedy era, you add in students and academics into that sort of core vote, if you like. And then that got broken at the end of the coalition era as trust of being the anti-establishment party was eroded. And that's not going to come back at the next election. And what happened in 2019 was that the Lib Dems decided to double down on going after the Tory Remain vote, even though it was the Labour Remain vote that was much, much larger constituency. That really hurt them and sort of helped to hasten their decline. So it was just really churlish. And rather than sort of working with Labour to get that second referendum and avoid a general election, they went for this nuclear option of revoke, and it was the wrong time for them to do that. So the risk is now that they're fighting that position now, even though we're almost a year on from that, and in a situation where they're on nowhere near the vote share.
It's an incredibly difficult political environment in the UK for a third party of any kind. There's a tendency from some on the Remain side to blame the small party, the Lib Dems, for somehow screwing up Brexit, when actually it was the Labour Party that wouldn't cooperate and wouldn't cooperate and wouldn't cooperate and, put the Labour Party first for month after month after month. Nevertheless, I sort of feel like we should just get over ourselves. The challenge is, what is any third party for? I joined the Liberal Democrats, 15 years ago, because I believed in pluralism, because I believed that politics needed a diversity of opinions. And the idea that there were just two big behemoth parties that dominated the ideas and you had to sort of just get in with the big crowd and that was the only way to make anything was just wrong. In a first past the post system, maintaining the electoral coalition that enables pluralism is incredibly, incredibly difficult. And it may be that it's gone for a generation and we need to think about how you create pluralism within the two larger political parties or how we open up debate. There will always be a space for liberalism, but the Liberal Democrats have a really difficult case to make. It's really an existential one about why people get involved in politics and what it's for. And that will take years to answer for even the greatest of thinkers. And I think of course Ed Davey should take the time when nobody knows who he is to think before he tries to lead. I think Naomi's completely wrong about him spending time on a local tour, listening, engaging with the voters. I think we need more politicians who are humble enough to do that.
I think it's right that he does it, but I think that likelihood of the impact is not going to be as bold as it was when Ashdown did it. And also because it feels a little bit like he's prejudged the outcome of that listening tour by saying things like when he was in the leadership election with Joe Swinson over a year ago, that he was much less in favour of working with other parties than she claimed to be. Sort of think about where some of that vote went in 2015, some of that anti-establishment, vote in the southwest of England, some of that vote, not an insignificant vote, a chunk of that vote went to UKIP because a lot of those voters are not that economically right wing. And where Dominic Cummings is incredibly clever is that he knows that the Conservatives are not popular with many of those voters and has been really helping to detoxify the party, particularly on its economic strategies and pursuing far more of far less of a laissez-faire economic policy agenda and doing much more around spending. And so
I don't understand. You're saying that Dominic Cummings is detoxifying the Conservative Party, which is a good strategy, but the Liberal Democrats being close to the Conservatives on anything is the wrong strategy because their voters are going to UKIP to justify a set of prejudices about the fact that the coalition was a mistake and that Tories are evil, whilst also saying nice things about the Tory strategy and the voters they're chasing.
No. What I'm saying is that Dominic Cummings is very clever to understand that there are some voters who are quite socially conservative that have traditionally voted liberal in parts of the country like the Southwest. And he understands that they are not that economically right-wing. There are policies that actually worked, that the Liberal Democrats had, that worked well with some of those groups. So things like, free social care for the elderly and penny on the pound for education and a 50% top rate of tax. They are a bit left-wing, but they're not too lefty for those kinds of voters. And what I'm saying is that the Lib Dems don't have a core vote at the moment. And I think by just sort of shadowing economically the Conservatives, they are very, very unlikely to succeed. And what it would have been, I suppose, helpful for the leader to be articulating in their speech is perhaps some of those sorts of moves, because the vast majority of Liberals do not vote for the Liberal Democrats. And study after study after study has shown of the electorate and voting patterns and things like the British Election Study Survey shows that most people who have Liberal tendencies tend to be centre-left. The majority, there are some on the centre-right, but the majority of them are on the centre-left. And so in order to be successful, the party is going to have to try and strike a balance between winning over some soft Conservative voters, but uniting the anti-Conservative vote behind it. And in order to do that, it's probably going to have to pursue moderate centre-left economic strategies.
So both of you, maybe start with you, Polly, first of all, and I'll ask the same question to you, Naomi. Do you think that the Lib Dems can rebuild, and specifically rebuild in time for the next election? What should they be aiming for, and how can they achieve it?
You know, what Paddy Ashdown built in the run-up to 97, which was then able to grow under Charles Kennedy, was a movement grounded in community politics, the community politics of Joe Grimmond, really, and the idea about being the best person locally. And that came crashing down in the coalition because suddenly the party was firmly attached in a very clear way to a set of national policies with which people could either agree or disagree. But crucially, you couldn't just be the good local person who was essentially the mayor of a constituency up in Parliament advocating for it. Does that mean that it should be the future for Liberal Democrats to just go back to distancing themselves from any of the big divides in politics and just being good locally? I feel like that would be a disservice to the principles of liberalism, their place in our national politics, and the need for pluralism within our parliament. What I'm not sure about is the pathway to victory for a party that pursues real liberalism. So I feel like if I was giving them political advice, I think I would choose the slightly blank space, good local party. And actually, I think that's what millions of people in their communities want, because they find politics just a massive turnoff.
Naomi, what do you think?
Well, I think that given that Labour don't want to talk about Brexit at all at the moment, there is now space for the Liberal Democrats to call out the limitations of any thin deal that Boris Johnson signs, if he even manages to sign one at all. Yesterday, John Curtis spoke about some new polling that shows that there is now the biggest gap between yes and no in answering the question, was it wrong to leave the EU? And so, yes, more and more and more people think it was wrong. And those people don't really have any leadership at the moment, and the Lib Dems could provide that. I also fear that they could have a negative impact at the next election of stopping this vote leave government, because the left is much more fractured than the right in this country. And we do need an alliance, therefore, between the Liberal Democrats and Labour at the next election, because the Lib Dems can get in the way and stop Labour winning some of those Conservative Labour marginals, because, you know, unfortunately, we don't live in a system with equal votes and a proportionate voting system. We have first past the post, and the Lib Dems do tend to take more votes from the left than the right. And that's the reality. So I think if there's anything to sort of hope for, it's that the party can call out this government on its failings on the Brexit deal and also work with Labour ahead of the next election.
Naomi Smith and Polly McKenzie, thanks ever so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
That's all from us this week. For anyone who missed the first US presidential election debate on Tuesday night, Jonathan Friedland stayed up all night so you didn't have to. Listen back to his conversation with Guardian columnist Richard Wolfe. You'll find it in the usual Politics Weekly feed. But for now, I want to thank our guests, Sonia Soda, Fiona Harvey, Polly McKenzie and Naomi Smith. The producer is Danielle Stevens. I'm Jessica Elgott. Please look after yourselves and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.